Good afternoon. It is 3 o'clock straight up, and this is Katie Bosler with a Juno Afternoon, filling in for a bit this summer for Scott Burton. Today we'll learn about the first annual Juno Roller Girls Lip Sync Bout with Charla Brown. We'll continue our Words 101 series with a focus on writing so people will keep reading with guests Stuart Cohen and Dick Callahan. Cianne Murphy will be here to spotlight this year's Poetry Omnibus. And we'll learn about a watercolor workshop July 11th at the Arboretum. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more today on KTOO News. And coming right up, we have National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Monday night, South Dakota Public Utilities Commissioners heard from more than 50 opponents and supporters of the Keystone XL pipeline. The gathering gave opponents an opportunity to address two topics deemed irrelevant to a longer hearing scheduled for the end of the month: climate change and tribal treaty rights. The utility approved the pipeline to run across the state in 2010, but since TransCanada failed to complete the project in 4 years, it has to certify it still meets conditions. Victoria Wicks reports.
Chaz Jewett is a member of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. She tells PUC commissioners that pipeline discussions must include concerns about climate change.
Tar sands is ridiculous. 8 gallons of water per every 1 gallon it produces? What are you guys going to drink in 25 years? And you guys are just, you know, pretending like we can't talk about this stuff in a real way. You guys sit here and say it's about jobs. The water's fine. Really? We can't drink the water out of the Morro and the Grand River.
While some tribal members appealed to the PUC to allow testimony about climate change, others asked commissioners to apply federal law stemming from the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. That treaty granted tribes of the Great Sioux Nation all land west of the Missouri River in South Dakota. Gary Dorr of Winter says even though the pipeline is not slated to cross current reservation boundaries, that does not mean it can legally cut through western South Dakota.
We're not talking about Indian country. We've never said that. The treaty rights apply to the reservation and to the territory described in the treaty.
Dorr says the proposed pipeline crosses treaty territory, and under federal law, treaty rights carry with the land forever. PUC Chairman Chris Nelson says commissioners have determined that the PUC does not have jurisdiction over treaty rights and climate change is not applicable to the question at hand, whether TransCanada can still comply with conditions set 4 years ago in the original permit. The PUC will hear from attorneys and witnesses in a 7-day legal hearing set to begin July 27th. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks reporting from Pierre.
U.S. and regional officials met recently with area residents at Chaco Canyon in New Mexico to discuss possible development. KGLP's Rachel Cobb reports.
Interior Deputy Secretary Connor accompanied U.S. Senator Udall of New Mexico to Chaco Canyon for meetings with stakeholders and officials from the local Bureau of Land Management, BLM, National Park Service, and Bureau of Indian Affairs. The BLM is currently working on a new resource management plan, or RMP, for the region, which would address the potential for oil and gas development to damage area air quality, water resources, the darkness of night skies, noise, and the experience of Chaco Canyon by visitors. The National Park Service recommends that no development take place closer than 10 miles away from Chaco Canyon. Connor spoke to the perceived safety of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking.
You know, fracking has been done when it's done correctly. You can minimize the impacts, and that will be certainly the expectation moving forward.
Victoria Gutierrez of Dene Care, Citizens Against Ruining Our Environment, who was at the meeting, does not believe that a 10-mile buffer is adequate.
We gave Senator Udall a letter and petitions from the community people. We need tests done on the air and what the flaring and the contaminants are doing to the local area. It doesn't only affect the eastern Navajo. It affects all of the San Juan Basin.
Officials believe that the RMP will be ready by the end of the year, after which further input will be considered. For National Native News, this is Rachel Cobb.
And now for a correction. On Monday, we reported on the selection of Lindsay Robertson as the Chickasaw Nation Chair at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. We reported that he's Native American when in fact he's not. The position is funded by and named in honor of the tribe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. This is your host, Katie Bosler, and with me in the studio is Charla Brown, and she is representing the Juno Roller Girls. Hello, Charla.
Hi, Katie. Thanks for having me.
We also happen to be colleagues at the University of Alaska Southeast. You know, we had this email relationship before that. But Charla, you're here to talk about a first annual, very special fundraiser, a lip sync bout.
Yes. So the Juno Roller Girls skate here in Juno at Centennial Hall. And for years, we've been skating directly on the wooden floor. And it's come to a point where we need to purchase a very expensive piece of sporting equipment that's fairly common for derby leagues to own, to the tune of about $20,000. That's for the equipment and shipping to get it up here. And so we are in the midst of this, what we've dubbed a skate of emergency, because without this piece of equipment, we cannot skate at Centennial Hall any longer. So this Saturday, July 11th, at the Rendezvous, we're having our first lip sync bout, also known as lip sync battle. And we're encouraging everyone to come out, because the owner, Deb Berry, generous sponsor, is basically providing all of her resources at our disposal, and 100% of ticket sales go directly to our skate of emergency.
Well, that sounds a lot of fun. So tell me about, how does a lip sync bout operate?
Okay. So, you know, for decades we've been doing karaoke in bars, and, you know, karaoke kind of comes down to actual musical ability, which you may or may not have, depending on how much you've had to drink. but a lip sync battle, if anybody hasn't heard of it, you can just Google search Jimmy Fallon lip sync battle. And
he is just making the most of that. So much fun.
So much fun. And you can really impersonate your inner pop star, you know, and it's more about your ability to appear like you're singing the song. Remember, like back in the day, what was it? Milli Vanilli or something, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. So that's what we're doing. And I'm going to channel my inner Beyonce. I mean, not Beyonce. Fergie. Sorry.
Oh, my gosh. Are you going to wear a red wig?
No, I don't think it'll be red, but I'll have feathers and boots. And I've been practicing quite a bit. So it'll be worth seeing my Fergie impersonation for $10, I'm sure.
Okay. So as far as the bout, is it roller girls who'll be competing against each other, or is this open to whoever shows up?
That's a great question. We have several roller girls who will be performing, and we also have members from the public. So we encourage anyone to compete. We want contestants. We want to have, you know, as many acts as possible, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Okay, so what's the entry fee?
$10.
Okay.
Not much. You can get them at brownpapertickets.com. You can buy them at the door, or you can purchase them at the Rockwell or Rendezvous in advance. But again, that's not required. Doors open at 6, lips roll at 8.
Lips roll. I like that. You know, you have a lot of good taglines there, you know.
Okay.
So tell me, Charla, how long have you been a roller girl?
You know, I showed up at the first practice last August, skates in hand and not really sure what I was able to do. Couldn't stop, that's for sure.
And your day job is?
I'm a professor in the School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast here in Juneau.
And what do you teach?
I teach business courses, change management, organizational effectiveness, human resources, you know, how to play well with others.
Okay, so here you are, a professor of things like organizational management, and what drew you to the roller girls?
You know, I ran into Bitter Glitter at the public market. No, it wasn't the public market. It's the one that happens in November, the Christmas thing. And she was manning the booth, and I wanted a T-shirt. I was new to Juno.
She was womaning the booth?
She was womaning the booth, yes. And, yeah, I've been in Juno, like, maybe 3 months or something. And I don't know. She was just super cool, and I was like, I want to find out more about this. And then, of course, my husband's like, oh, you should do it. I'm like, what? I read what you have to do to compete. And I'm like, I will hurt myself. I don't think I can do that. And then the Sick of Slayers came to town just a couple months later. And
Well, of course, the Sick of Slayers showed up. You got
to
be fascinated.
The Sick of Slayers showed up, and I went to a bout, and I'm like, I could totally do that. And I showed up, and the girls have just been super wonderful, coaching me, training me, giving me advice, constructive criticism.
So there's a lot of camaraderie, support,
yeah.
That team kind of stuff.
Yeah, we practice, yeah. Well, the team's practices, they 2.5 hours on Monday night, 2.5 hours on Wednesday night, and then scrimmage on Sunday.
So getting back to Bitter Glitter, everybody has a roller girl name,
mm-hmm.
And that must be her name.
That's her name.
What is your name?
My name is Latter Day Shank.
Latter Day Shank. Nice. Well, you know, quite frankly, it sounds kind of terrifying. Mm-hmm. Were you terrified the first time you know?
I wouldn't say I've been terrified. I just, you know, it's a progressive skill that you develop. And as I learn to skate, I become more comfortable. I'm still very, very new. I'm considered to be fresh meat in the derby world. But you just build skill upon skill, and you become more comfortable with different things. And derby, you know, you're in each other's personal space. But the whole concept is, it's about women empowerment. We're being physically active and fit, and we're working together. We're collaborating. I know in the past, derby maybe has had a different kind of, I don't know what the word is. People perceive derby in different ways. But we are a member of the Women's Flat Track Derby Association, which is a nationally recognized league. Our goal is to be ranked among the top 100 among the nation. And we travel to Seattle, down to the lower 48, Anchorage, here in Southeast Alaska. I mean, it's not a sport to be taken lightly. The gear is expensive. The travel is expensive. It's a huge time commitment. We're all women. We have jobs. We have family. We have children. We have other commitments. And, you know, to make derby part of your life, it really says something about what it can be to anyone. And we encourage new recruits. We have training courses, you know, Skater 101.
So people want to know more about the derby. Where would they go? Is there a website or
Yeah,
email?
We have a website, junorollergirls.com. If anybody's interested in finding out more about the lip sync and maybe registering, wanting to find out maybe the rules to compete, they can email me at sportcourt@junorollergirls.com. And they can also donate online directly to our Skate of Emergency right there on the website.
Okay, so how long has the Skate of Emergency been in place?
You know, we found out last season that we were going to need to do this.
That you needed a sport court.
Mm-hmm. And we've raised about $4,000. And we've talked to some people who are selling courts. And, you know, it's going to be a collaborative effort with the Centennial Hall. They've graciously offered to store the court. I mean, not only do we have to buy it and get it here, but it's like 6 pallets of 10,000 pieces. And, you know, for every bout, we'll have to put it together and take it down. It's a commitment to derby here in Juneau. And without the court, the sport court, we won't be able to compete anymore.
Okay, well, Sharla Brown, to compete in the lip sync bout at the Rendezvous on Saturday at 6, you can just go ahead and get your tickets in advance or just show up.
Yeah, just show up at the door.
All right.
The more the merrier. We think it's going to be a great, great time.
All right, anything you'd like to add?
Just support your local roller girls here in Juneau. We'd love for everyone to come out and make it an event we want to be able to repeat in the future and support our Skate of Emergency.
Well, Charla Brown, thank you so much for coming
in. Katie.
I mean, Latter Day Shank. And we have, of course, both colleagues at the university. And here we have a former colleague, Wendy J. Gervin, with her first CD queued up right here.
Thank you, Katie.
Good luck with the bout.
Okay.
Call me up in the middle of the night while that train in your head just ain't running right by. I'm on the 518, I'm headed out of town. I can't pull over, you can't flag me down. It's been a year since I first saw your face. There are things I can't remember, things that I can't change, like your old number and my last name. Handful of reasons, heart full of pain. I've been waiting, waiting on a train to carry me forward, cause I can't go back the same way. And I've grown tired standing out in the rain. Think I'm southward bound. I saw your mama, she asked how I've been. I said there's a hole in my heart where your memory lives. It fills up my covers and wearing my shoes. Up late in the evening, walking floors over you. I've been waiting, waiting on a train to carry me forward, cause I can't go back the same way. And I've grown tired just standing out in the rain. Think I'm southward bound. I'm going to a place where the sun always shines. I hear that grass is greener past the Mason-Dixon line. Well, I think about you as the miles go by. When I reach that platform, there'll be no more tears to cry. I've been waiting, waiting on a train to carry me forward, cause I can't go back the same way. And I've grown tired just standing out in the rain. Think I'm southward bound. Oh, I'm southward bound. You can't flag me down.
Wendy Jo Gervin on a Juno Afternoon with Taking It Slow, and that is from The Last Secret, her brand new and first CD. And Wendy, once, of course, a librarian at the University of the Southeast, now in Maine, and very excited to share her just received music here at the station. This is Katie Bosler, and you are listening to a Juno Afternoon, and our producer, Jeff Brown, has a summer series called Writing 101, or Words 101, and the focus today is how to get and keep a reader's attention. And with me in the studio are two local writers, Stuart Cohen and Dick Callahan. Welcome, gentlemen.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks, Katie.
It's good to have you both here. Now, Stuart is out with a new book called This Is How It Really Sounds, which I absolutely love that title. And this is a work of fiction, and Dick, is his latest book is called The Gear List of the Golden Moon, which is a work of nonfiction. And, well, first of all, for those who are not familiar with your latest works, maybe I can have each of you just give a little sort of nutshell about your latest book.
Gear List of the Golden Moon is essentially that. Rowing / sailing trip from Juneau to Seattle, and spent a lot of time figuring out what to take, and everybody has different ideas about what they should bring with them and or what you should bring with you. So I just kind of distilled it all down into 90 pages of what worked for me.
Okay. Yeah. And how about you, Stuart?
Well, this book is part of it. It's kind of hard to describe the plot. Part of it's about a faded rock star who's lost all his money. And part of it's about this kind of disgraced financier who's living large on his ill-gotten hundreds of millions of dollars in Shanghai and looking for the meaning of life. And another character is the world extreme skiing champion circa 1991. And then there's some other various strange characters in there, too.
Well, you got my attention already. So it usually goes to prove correct, in my experience as a reader, is if something really catches my attention from the beginning and intrigues me, I'm going to want to keep reading. And if it doesn't, well, you know, I guess if you look to talk about Victorian novels, maybe you have to be a little more patient. But then more often than not, I'm going to put it down before I'm finished.
Mm-hmm.
So could each of you share with us, you know, do you have any things you keep in mind to start off a book?
Well, I try and let the reader know that there's something really at stake here, that there's from that first sentence and from that first, you know, page, they need to know that this is a about a vital human situation they can relate to, such as a dead body is found in a car and you get that call because you're a policeman and you're called by the chief to investigate it and you're the one who committed the murder. And that's why the chief called you. So you know right away you have something that's deep and profound about person's character, about the human situation. So,
sure. So you relate to it as a human being.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Viscerally.
Yeah. And I do want to add that plenty of people have sold many, many books doing the opposite of whatever I say. So this is just my take on it.
What's your take, Dick?
Well, I in my fiction books, I tend to work with or gravitate toward controversial topics. And so I want to let the reader know early on that what's in it for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what can I learn from this or glean from this or imagine myself in this situation possibly?
Yeah. And why is this important? And what's the scenario in society today?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you rode from here to Seattle in a dory that you made?
No, it's an East Coast boat. It was
East
built
Coast
at Lowell's Boat Shop in Massachusetts.
Okay, but yeah. That alone, that's fascinating, right? So to me, I think, well, I want to know how this person did this.
Well, Gearless of the Golden Moon is a nonfiction book.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially just my travels. But the trip itself is the vehicle for my next book. That's ostensibly why I took the trip, got the boat and took the trip, which is a really great part of mm-hmm. writing, is that you can do whatever you want and say, mm-hmm. well, it's research.
Yeah. So this is a work of fiction, your next book?
The next book's going to be, yeah.
So tell me about your fiction writing, and is it really very different from your nonfiction style?
It changes over time, I guess. But yeah, it's becoming shorter and less is more. I think my writing style generally is becoming what would the word be?
Succinct.
Succinct. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I wonder about that too. I mean, I was noticing the beginning of your book, Stuart, is very succinct, and it just kind of takes you on a ride from the beginning. And I was wondering about that. Is that partially because of what I call the mass ADD generation? That, you know, people's attention span is decreasing because of all the distractions of technology and social media stuff. So do you have to kind of think about that now when you're writing?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it. I think I like – it depends what you're interested in. You know, certainly there are readers who love books that are just – that I find to be just ponderous, impenetrable piles of words, you know, where the plot moves along at a glacial pace, but all the writing is beautiful and there's metaphors and poetry.
Ponderous and impenetrable.
Yes, but there are people who love that kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what interests me. I'm more interested in plot and structure and, you know, how plot development develops and where it brings the reader. So if I might use words, a certain kind of words, to create a mood, and I might slow things down at certain times. But generally, I'm interested in, I like to have a kind of, it's like the guy sitting around a fire, the caveman, and like, you know, one guy says, yeah, and then Og moved closer to the mammoth, and he just swept him aside, and his spear went flying out of his hand. And then there's a silence and everybody's like, and then what happened? And that's kind of where I'm at with when I'm writing.
And when you talk about structure and plot, do you kind of make like an outline, like almost a storyboard?
No, I usually have no idea what's going to happen.
How about you, Dick?
I haven't in the past, and I let the story go where it goes, and it happens over a period of 2 years or more, and so it can go a lot of places. But I'm working on an outline for my next book.
I tried an outline, and it turned out nothing like my outline.
Yeah, you might find that. That's what people say who do outlines, but at least it gives you something to look at every day and kind of narrow down your focus, I think.
So you think it's more of an act of intuition or just being open to what's coming through?
For me, both those things, yeah. I mean, it's also, yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Although coming through makes it sound like it sort of effortlessly comes through. It's more like a lot of days just like, what am I going to write about today? I have absolutely no idea, but I can't walk out of this office 6 hours later and not have done anything. And so you just kind of throw some stuff out there, and then you might get surprised.
And you know what's interesting about that is the whole concept of writer's block. Maybe everybody has writer's block. Maybe like 99% of people who sit down to write something have no idea what they're really going to do until they start. Just throwing it out there. I don't know.
I feel like I have writer's block every day.
I can relate to that feeling.
I always have a couple of different projects, and if it's not happening with this one, I have other things that I can work on.
Have a plan B.
I do. Well, it just, yeah, plan B happens. But I think it was a really astute observation that readership has changed for in terms of how people are willing to hang with a book from readership of 40 years ago, say.
Yes, yes. Well, Jeff Brown marked in your book, Stuart, one sentence in particular that just really struck him. And I think this is one of those that kind of makes the reader slow down a little bit. And that is, everything he wanted was contained in this motion and the opacity of the evening in front of them. And something about the opacity of the evening just sort of carried Jeff away. And did that just sort of come to you, or how?
I think that when I wrote that, that must be in the part where he's in the Chinese garden or heading towards the Chinese garden with this kind of ephemeral woman that he doesn't really know very well or understand. And he's, at that point, I think he's taken a bunch of ecstasy, too. But this is the financier. I don't know. I think with that sentence, I was trying to capture a feeling that I've often had many times where you're just kind of it's everything is kind of mysterious and completely unknown, and it's like it's like you've kind of parachuted into somebody else's life.
Did you have moments like that on your dory trip down the Inside Passage?
Parachuting into somebody's life. I guess I was parachuting into my own life on the boat. It took me about 5 weeks to feel like I was in the boat. And that's a concept that I'm spending a lot of time with, of being where you are, and of being small, being really, really small in a huge landscape. Which, if you live here, it's a terrific place to develop that concept, because when you hear from agents in New York, they want to have larger than life characters, and everything's larger than life, and.
Like my whole life is larger than life.
We're not really very big, and so I'm working on that, of finding my character's place in a huge landscape.
And when you say it took 5 weeks to just kind of be there, you mean because you were just sort of incongruous that you were actually doing this, and there was all this stuff to process and get used to, and then. All of a sudden, whoa, I'm here, I'm doing this, I'm part of this Inside Passage? Or
to not being in a hurry, or to not be trying to get someplace else, especially not to try to be someplace else, to be right there, not wishing I was back there, not wishing I was done with it. And people would ask me, where are you going? And I would just say to whatever the next town was, because that way I didn't have to explain a whole lot about it. But if they pressed it, I would say, well, you know, I'm not really concerned about what happens after the next town. I'm just going to be right here. And everybody got it. Everybody that I talked to said, wow, it's, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a lifelong challenge for a lot of us, especially, again, with even though we live in this larger-than-life, if you will, place with not nearly as many distractions as, say, New York City, we're still just kind of just buzzing around like bees. And then when you put yourself in a situation like you did in the story, you know, paddling down the Inside Passage, like, okay, this is – I have to, like, slow down and be what really is more natural, if you will.
Yeah, it sounds like exactly the opposite of what my last book was about. although I kind of got into that same place in a way. It's kind of looking at that phenomenon of just being completely there, but sort of from the outside.
Well,
so,
yes. Well, this is how it really sounds. Where does that come from? I'm absolutely fascinated by that.
Well, it actually sort of relates to what Dick was saying, you know? There's these, basically a lot of the characters, one of the characters is this faded rock star who's been trying since his early 20s to write this song that eludes him. And it's a song that was inspired by being outside a house and seeing this farmhouse across a field and kind of envisioning in this kind of lost place in Western Pennsylvania and envisioning his whole life there and what those people's lives are like. And you keep seeing that house appears throughout the book, but in different places seen by different characters. The book's really about the house. The original title was The House at Wilkes-Barre, but that's kind of 19th century. So this character's continually trying to write that song, and it always eludes him of what that's about. And that idea of how things really sound, it's kind of like the Zen thing of that realization, as Dick says, that we are really small, and this is what it really is. Like, it's not really about I'm some big financier who's just made a big killing and I'm a big dog or I'm a big rock star or I'm a big, you know, fame, you know, extreme skier. It's just like, this is what it really is. And so they're all kind of in search of that throughout the book. So I don't know if that's...
Well, Jeff, it's dangerous to have me interview writers because I could just go on and on. But the other thing, I'm just more literally about sound and writing, I'm very interested in, and we'll wrap it up real soon here, but I'm interested from each of you. Do you use sound in your revising and your editing process as far as how the sentence sounds to you when you read it aloud, or you might present it to other people if you're presenting your work?
Reading it aloud is the best thing that you can do before you give it to other people to read, to actually, and not just to read it to yourself, but to read it out loud. And definitely to see how it sounds and to see if there are words that jump out at you. Like, I use this word in this paragraph and this word two paragraphs later, and it's an eccentric word, and it shouldn't be on the same page or even within 40 pages of each other. And so, yeah, sure, I definitely would say I use sounds.
Yeah,
I say, this is how it sounds.
I do too. I read it aloud, and I talk to myself a lot.
Do you ever tell it to yourself out? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I talk to myself a lot. In fact, I had to warn the person in the office next to me, I'm not mentally ill. I'm just kind of like to talk to myself, which I guess that's not very explanatory. But I do use sound. Yeah.
So do you tell yourself the story sometimes, or just start to say it before you write it down?
Read it to myself. I don't know if I read it out loud. No, I'm usually just like talking, yeah, or saying things that a character might say, usually before I've written it down. I can't remember if I read things out loud or not, but I know I talk a lot. I don't know what I say.
Well, so there's all variations of this on either side of the writing, on all sides of the writing process. I know Sherman Alexie, for example, he tells the story first orally, and then he writes it down.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. Guys, this has been fantastic.
Oh,
thank you so much for coming in.
This
is How It Really Sounds, is Stuart Archer Cohen's latest book. You can get it at Hearthside Books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or there's an audio book and Kindle and stuff like that.
And Dick Callahan, your book is The Gear List of the Golden Moon. Where can we find that?
That would also be at Hearthside locally.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for coming
in. Thank you, Katie.
And it's time for Mr. Keeler and the Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 7th of July, 2015. It's the birthday of the artist Marc Chagall, born in Vitebsk, Russia, 1887, one of nine kids in a family of modest means. He eventually was accepted to art school in St. Petersburg and then in Paris, where he began to develop his style. Known for bright colors and fantastical images from Russian Jewish folklore, ghosts and livestock, weddings, fiddlers, and a couple floating in the sky, and also fish. It was on this date, 1930, Congress approved funds to build the Hoover Dam in Black Canyon on the border of Nevada and Arizona. The dam used enough concrete to pave a highway from San Francisco to New York, built during the Great Depression, employed more than 21,000 men, many of them unskilled. More than 100 lives were lost, many of them from heat prostration and also from carbon monoxide poisoning. The dam was completed in 1935, 2 years ahead of schedule. Hydroelectric plant, which produces over 2,000 megawatts of electricity, enough to serve more than a million people in Nevada, Arizona, and California. President Roosevelt dedicated the dam in 1935. Herbert Hoover was not invited to attend. It's the birthday of Gustav Mahler, born in Bohemia, 1860, who said, "If you think you're boring your audience, go slower, not faster." It's the birthday of the science fiction writer Robert Heinlein, born in Butler, Missouri, in 1907, wrote more than 50 novels, best known for Stranger in a Strange Land, about a boy born during the first manned mission to Mars, who is raised by Martians and then returns to Earth. He called his book speculative fiction rather than science fiction, writing about events that he believed could actually happen. Robert Heinlein, who said, "I think that science fiction, even the corniest of it, even the most outlandish of it, no matter how badly it's written, has a distinct therapeutic value because all of it has as its primary postulate that the world does change." And it's the birthday of the historian David McCullough, born in Pittsburgh, 1933, who once said that the time that he spent writing the biography of John Adams and his book 1776 were the happiest years of his writing life. He said, "I'd never ventured into the 18th century before, never set foot in it. I told my wife the other day that I might never come back. I love it." Here's a poem for today by Robert Graves entitled Whole Love. Every choice is always the wrong choice. Every vote cast is always cast away. How can truth hover between alternatives? Then love me more than dearly, love me wholly, love me with no weighing of circumstance, as I am pledged in honor to love you, with no weakness, with no speculation on what might happen should you and I prove less than bringers to be of our own certainty. Neither was born by hazard, each foreknew the extreme possession we are grown into." Robert Graves' poem, Whole Love. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Ah, yes, Garrison Keeler and the Writer's Almanac. What a lovely poem. And we're going to talk more about poetry with C.N. Murphy, who is here to represent Poetry Omnibus for 2015.
Hi, Katie.
Hi. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here.
You are taking over this year as the facilitator of this noble effort.
Yes, ma'am. Carol Race has done it for the past couple years so graciously, and she's passed it on to me. So now is the time to get on the air and promote.
Yes. Yeah, so tell me about Poet, for those who haven't heard, what is Poetry Omnibus?
So Poetry Omnibus is a local juried program for poetry. We usually have about 26 participants that get their poems posted up on the Capital Transit buses. And it's a juried competition, but it's a healthy, fun, positive thing. You know, everyone's welcome to put a poem into the competition. And I really don't want to say it's competition, but there's a fourth grade level is the earliest age group. So fourth grade and up, mm-hmm. and then there's adults that can submit.
And the poems are no more than 10 lines.
Correct.
Can a line be like, is there a limit to the line length?
Well, they all have to like basically fit on a place card. So if you've ever ridden on the bus, you can see there's like the little advertisements and everything that are up there. So I would have to like look at the poem that the judges would pick. And
now is it no more than 10 lines?
It's 10 lines total, so that includes your line breaks between stanzas.
Okay, so. It has to be 10 lines total.
Yeah.
Okay, got
so,
it.
So, but any form of poetry that you want to put up, you can, and everything has to be appropriate for public viewing, so.
So when you say as a fourth grade level, so do many, I from what I've observed, a lot of elementary school students participate. Sometimes with their classrooms.
Yep. Some years there's been a good contribution from the grade schoolers, but last year there were only like a couple. So if there's any teachers out there in the fourth and fifth grade that are interested in getting in contact, maybe doing a poetry workshop, please go ahead and contact me, and we can try to make things happen in your classroom. So we can get some submissions from the kids.
So you'll be doing poetry workshops in classrooms for those teachers who solicit you to do so?
We can try to arrange doing that. Yep. We have a couple people that have done this in the past. So,
well, this effort now has been going on for quite a few years.
It has. It's in its ninth year. Started in 2006. And it was kind of taken after things in New York and London, just some big cities where there's poetry in public places. So,
and how did you get involved as the facilitator this year?
Well, I had been a judge last year, and the year prior I submitted a poem for extra credit in one of my UAS classes.
Oh, really?
So I got my extra credit, and yeah, one of the poems.
Was this one of the creative writing classes?
It was.
Oh, yes. Interesting.
Yeah, so, and that's actually how I found out about it. So we're here to promote it as much as possible. There are going to be submission forms over at the Jack and at the library. So I'm going to get those out in a couple weeks as soon as I get back to town. So I'll look for those in a couple weeks. And then you can go to jahc.org, and under the events tab, just go to the Poetry Omnibus tab, and then you can read up on Poetry Omnibus, and then there's a link to the submission form.
Okay, and where do you submit?
So you can either do it in person at the Jack, or you can do it online.
Okay.
And that's at the Jack website.
Okay, so that's pretty easy. There's just two different there's a physical location at the Jack or on the jahc.org website.
Yeah, and so the first poem submission is free, and then submissions thereafter, you have to pay $3 for each additional poem, and you can submit 3 poems per person.
And what is the deadline?
The deadline is going to be October 15th.
Okay, so for writers who sometimes tend to be procrastinators, that sounds like next year.
It's a while. You got a few months. So, and you know, it doesn't have to be something that you write for right now. If you have something that you wrote 10, 15 years ago or a few weeks ago, you can submit it. So,
or you could revise it a little bit.
You could. We ask that all the poems that you submit be in their final form. So,
well, Sianne Murphy, is there anything else you'd like to add about Poetry Omnibus for this year?
If you have any questions, please email us at junopoets@gmail.com. And, go to the JAC website and check out the link if you're interested.
Okay, junopoets@gmail.com for more information or if you have any questions. October 15th, the deadline. And then there's also the guidelines at jahc.org.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I feel the shadows now upon me.
That was Won't You Come and Sing for Me with Anna and Elizabeth. And as a matter of fact, they'll be singing for us tomorrow night at the Gold Town Nick. And I believe that starts at 7:30. I'll clarify that if I need to later with you. This is Katie Bosler filling in here for Scott Burton for a few weeks this summer on a Juno afternoon on Tuesdays. And with me in the studio is Allison Gillum from the Southeast Alaska Land Trust and Tim Ortiz from the Canvas. And they're going to tell us about a watercolor workshop happening this Saturday out the road at the Arboretum. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So the Canvas and the Southeast Alaska Land Trust are partnering for this venture. Tell us a little bit about that, how this whole thing came about.
Yeah, well, the Southeast Alaska Land Trust holds a conservation easement on the Jensen Olsen Arboretum, which is basically a legal covenant that makes sure that development doesn't occur in the Arboretum and that the Arboretum will be the Arboretum forever, which is a great resource for our town. And the Land Trust wanted to do an event to kind of connect the community with one of our properties and do something fun out there. And so we thought about doing some sort of art event, and the Canvas is a great partner, so we decided to reach out to them.
Yeah, at the Canvas, this is perfect for us because we've been looking for more opportunities to make art outside this summer because the weather has been so incredible. So we have every Saturday we have a little drawing group that gets together for $20 to work in the studio. And so this we've decided for this weekend we're going to go out to the Arboretum and we're going to do watercolor. It's going to be really excellent. Our most popular drawing group so far has been one in which we did local wildflowers because drawing and painting flowers, real flowers from life, is just one of the most incredible, simple, beautiful experiences. It's very accessible, it's very easy, it's very fun. And learning how to do it in watercolor is so enriching and wonderful. So this is perfect. The Arboretum has such an incredible selection of beautiful flowers to work from. And so there's never been a better time and place to do this wonderful thing than this weekend.
So to participate, do you just show up out there or at the Canvas and go together? How's that going to work out?
So there's registration on the Southeast Alaska Land Trust website, which is just www.southeastalaskalandtrust.org. And there's a link there to register and to either pay online or you can send check or cash, and it's $20 per person.
Okay, and so you want people to register in advance?
Yeah.
You can't just show up.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and then do you just meet out there?
Yep, you can meet out there, and we'll have the materials provided, watercolor and paper and all of that, and I'll be doing the teaching. So, yeah, you won't need to bring anything else. It'll just register in advance and show up.
And again, what time does it start on Saturday?
So there's actually two classes. There's one from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m., and then the second afternoon class is from 12:30 p.m. to 2:30 p.m.
Okay, and Tim, you're kind of an artist in residence, if you will, at the Canvas this year.
Yeah, sort of. The Canvas has their primary function in the studio there is to work with artists with developmental disabilities, and that group of artists benefits from having a lot of different perspectives. Since they're working in that studio long term for many years, in many cases, have lots of different people coming through, especially from out of town, is beneficial. So one of the things Canvas offers them is having artists come on for a year at a time to just teach their particular perspective and way of thinking about art. I expose them to that. So me and one other artist, Andreana Donahue, are doing that this year. Mm-hmm. And we're teaching some other classes for the community during that time. Down at the Canvas.
So these workshops on Saturday, you'll have the canvases and the paints already set up for people on the easels?
Yeah, what we do on Saturdays is a drawing group. So it's primarily work on paper. If people want to bring down materials, we allow that absolutely to use the studio. That's Saturday mornings from 10 to noon.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been trying to provide a model as often as possible. It all depends on attendance, but we have a group on Facebook where we provide information about what we're going to be doing in the drawing group each week. And that's just a drop-in thing. You don't need to sign up in advance. Mm-hmm. Just you can pay when you come down, $20.
Okay, but if you register to do this workshop this weekend at the Arboretum, you'll be doing some painting with watercolors.
Yes, painting on paper. Watercolors, typically done on paper. So for this workshop this weekend, it'll be on paper and we'll provide all that.
And how about for those who have always wanted to, engage their inner Monet but are just a little bit hesitant? What do you tell those people?
This doesn't need to be a scary thing at all. This is watercolor painting is in this kind of context is so exciting and so forgiving. And drawing things from life, especially drawing flowers, there's a lot of leeway to just get the essence of something and have it still look really satisfying and correct because the shapes are so irregular to begin with. And so it's all there for you out at the Arboretum. There's so much, inspiring stuff to look at. It'll be a fun thing. It won't be a particularly challenging thing. it'll just be really, really satisfying and fun, I think.
And we'll get you out there. The Arboretum is one of those places where I say, I got to get out there. And then it gets up to be October. You go, what happened? I didn't get out there. So if anything, it's an excuse to get out to that beautiful, beautiful place. Well, Tim and Allison, is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, that's it for me.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in to tell us about these watercolor workshops this Saturday at the Arboretum. And Allison, just one more time, just give people the basics, those who might be just tuning in.
Right. There is going to be a watercolor workshop out at the Jensen Olson Arboretum on Saturday, this coming Saturday. Two classes, one in the morning from 10 to noon, one in the afternoon from 12:30 to 2:30. To register in advance, go to www.southeastalaskalandtrust.org. There's a registration link and a payment link there. And we hope to see you out there. I'll be out there for the morning class.
And so will the birds. Where there's flowers, there's birds, right? Here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. It's just after dawn in the piney woods of Georgia. Suddenly, from out of a hole 40 feet up in a large pine tree, pop four black and white birds. A family of red-cockaded woodpeckers is leaving their night roost. Native to the southeast, red-cockaded woodpeckers differ from most woodpeckers. They remain in cooperative family groups throughout their lives, and they excavate nests in living trees rather than dead ones, often reusing the same cavities for decades. To nest successfully, these woodpeckers need mature, open pine forests, a habitat requirement that has jeopardized their very survival as a species. When John James Audubon walked these woods in the 1830s, the woodpecker was abundant. A century and a half later, the federal government listed the red-cockaded woodpecker as endangered. Habitat loss is the problem. Most mature pines in the southeast have been cut down. The good habitat that remains is fragmented, and breeding woodpeckers are now isolated in ever smaller gene pools. Better management of federal forests and protection of the woodpeckers on private land can slow their decline. But much more needs to be done to ensure the long-term survival of this emblematic bird of the American Southeast. Learn more at birdnote.org.
Listening to A Juno Afternoon, and this is your host, Katie Bosler. And I wanted to let you know that at 4:30 today, the only finalist for the new president of the University of Alaska, Jim Johnson, will be at a community forum at Centennial Hall. I believe it is in the Hickel Room. So if you want to meet that finalist for the new University of Alaska president, Jim Johnson, he is in town. That'll be at 4:30 today. I want to thank all of our guests who we heard from today. Of course, we heard from Charla Brown from the Roller Girls. We heard from Stuart Cohen and Dick Callan on Callahan Writers on how to keep your readers' attention. We heard from Sian Murphy on Poetry Omnibus, and we heard from Allison Gillum and Tim Ortiz on the watercolor workshop happening this Saturday at the Arboretum. Tomorrow on A Juno Afternoon, we'll talk to Samantha Farinella about the screening of Hunting in Wartime. Hear the music of Anna and Elizabeth, who are performing tomorrow night at the Gold Town at 7 o'clock. Yes, at 7 o'clock at the Gold Town. You've heard their music today at this program. The CBJ Utility Superintendent Samantha Stoghanger about the state of Juneau's water. And you'll also hear from Kurt Jacobson, artist in residence at the Ernest Greening Cabin. Who knew? And your hostess tomorrow will be Lori Scandling.
K220BT in Huna and K210AS, an excursion inlet in Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
The past cannot be changed, but the future depends on our action, and it is our responsibility to ensure a bright future.
The head of it.